Thank you all for being here. We're delighted to have you here tonight for a conversation on free speech and the free press with investigative reporter and all-around intellectual gadfly, Matt Taibbi. I'm the only person up here tonight not wearing a tie because I thought for sure a gonzo journalist would not show up in a tie, and I wanted to look cool, and it was too late to go put one on. Matt has had a long and storied career in journalism, a longtime political reporter, columnist for Rolling Stone, winner of the 2008 National Magazine Award for columns and commentary, author of 10 books, including the New York Times bestsellers Insane Clown President and most recently Hate Incorporated, Why Today's Media Makes Us Despise One Another. But in early 2020, he left Rolling Stone to hang out his own shingle at Substack, where his site Racket News is near the top of the charts with over 360,000 subscribers, something like that.
Yeah. 400,000.
Yeah. Oh, I shortchanged him. But he is most famous lately for being the first to look at and report on the Twitter files. That's the treasure trove of internal communications at Twitter, giving everyone a look under the hood at what was going on with what turned out to be a fairly massive federal campaign to lean on social media companies and suppress speech. Now that's all, I think, interesting enough for an introduction, but there's more. I should say most of the time when I'm doing this sort of thing, when I have to do an introduction, I'm often introducing a career academic or worse, a career politician. And by and large, these aren't the most interesting people in the world. So you have to sort of scour the web, and if you want to spice it up, you have to go truffle hunting for just some little detail that suggests there was a spark of adventure in that person at some point. This time, I really didn't have to strain. It's an embarrassment of riches right there in the official bio. So around the time Matt graduated college, the Soviet Union conveniently collapsed, and he went east, young man, to make his mark in journalism. And this is actually from the official bio. He focused on participatory journalism, working in a series of jobs to show ordinary Russian life. A bricklayer in Siberia, worked as a moonshine dealer, a professional clown, a keeper in an elephant cage, and a construction worker in an Orthodox monastery. This next bit is from Wikipedia, so I can't vouch for its total accuracy, but Taibbi was deported from Uzbekistan in 1992 for writing an article for the Associated Press critical of President Islam Karimov. At the time of his deportation, he was the starting left fielder for the Uzbek national baseball team. He later moved to Ulaanbaatar, Mongolia, where he played professional basketball and became known as the Mongolian Rodman. He also worked for a short time as an investigator at a Boston-based private detective agency. I read a lot of crime novels. I suspect this might be one of those jobs that sounds a lot cooler than it is, and we may come back to that. First, I'd like to ask Matt about the Twitter files. This tranche of documents first of all, I refuse to call Twitter X. Because whatever Elon Musk wants, because then I'd be asking about the X files and we'd all get confused. But you got a close look starting, you know, in late 2022 at all these internal communications from Twitter that many of which revealed a massive governmental pressure campaign. Can you tell us what you can about how this opportunity came about, and also what, in your view, are the most disturbing revelations that either you or the other recipients of other parts of the files found?
Sure, thanks. First of all, Gene, thank you for that introduction. That was great.
Wrote itself.
And I also wanted to say thank you to everybody for coming out, and thank you to the Cato Institute. I probably wasn't terribly in sync with Cato on a lot of issues earlier in my career when I was reporting on Wall Street. But now I think Cato has a position of critical importance in American society, and I believe that more than ever after doing the Twitter files, we can get to why. For a couple of reasons, we're in a period where individual liberty has been denigrated and downplayed probably more than ever in our recent history. And also the entire idea of principled civil society organizations is now at risk because there's a general belief, as we found in the Twitter files, that these organizations should really not be serving as checks and balances to one another and to government, but should be working in concert, sort of under the table in a sub rosa way with government agencies. So anyway, I just wanted to thank the Cato Institute because I think they're a critically important organization right now. The Twitter files came about in a really weird way. Obviously, Elon Musk is an eccentric billionaire who bought a company for $44 billion, a little bit as a joke, partly because he was online a lot and there were things about the online experience he didn't like. And he had hinted publicly that he was going to release some files. So I knew that he was a reader of my site, and I mentioned something in one of my articles to the effect that if he were to open up those files, then he would become an American folk hero. Shortly after that, there was somebody from Twitter reached out to me, and it turned out that myself, the former New York Times writer Barry Weiss, Michael Schellenberger, and a few other reporters, we got this incredible opportunity to look through basically anything we wanted, and it was a very strange situation because normally, when a source comes to a journalist, they have a very specific idea of what they want out of press coverage. In this case, it was the exact opposite. We were told, you can look at anything you want, and we don't really care what it is. We knew there was going to be some kind of review, but they didn't really care what the search terms were. So we were just given big masses of documents and didn't really know where to start in terms of what the plot would be. And it took, a good 3 weeks or a month of constant reading and research about all these different organizations and acronyms that we were seeing in the company's internal emails to realize that there was at least one story that we could settle on that made sense and that we could prove, which was that the FBI, the Department of Homeland Security, and the Office of the Director of National Intelligence had a systematic system of communication back and forth with Twitter and other internet platforms through which they delivered enormous quantities of recommendations about content. You can quibble over whether or not that constitutes a First Amendment violation, but I think it was something none of us were prepared for. We thought maybe we would find one or two phone calls from the FBI about this or that. Instead, we were finding spreadsheets, thousands at a time, saying these are accounts that we're concerned about. You may choose to find them in violation of your community standards. Whole offices of the FBI were working sometimes on this project. They were doing nothing but looking for violations of Twitter's terms of service. We found one situation where the Baltimore field office was doing nothing but that. It was an extraordinary story, and it was very, very challenging because we had to do a lot of it fast. There was a lot of public criticism, and I think, you know, in the long run, even though the initial coverage was not great, I think the public got a lot out of it, and it spurred a lot of conversation, which I think was positive.
And these communications were not all like, gee, this seems like it might be wrong or perhaps violent, right? Like there is a very, and at least some of them that I've seen, a very sort of, you know, threatening tone to some of them at least.
Yeah, that's actually a really good point. In the entire realm of, you know, it's probably 150,000 emails and, you know, more communications than that if you include the Slack chats and things that we were looking at, we found exactly one instance of a Twitter employee saying, maybe this is a bad idea. In terms of, this came actually during the debate over whether or not to ban Donald Trump after January 6th. And there was a question of, well, is this going to lead us down a slippery slope of being in a position where we're somehow above the politicians who run the country? Isn't that a dangerous place for a tech company to be? And that person was, of course, ignored. But there was only one of those instances, and that we looked for more.
And one thing that's surprising to me is that, you know, when this came out, and some of it, you know, first they came for the insane anti-vaxxers, and I was not an insane anti-vaxxer, so therefore I said nothing. But they very quickly got into shadow banning or de-amplifying people that were well qualified and were, you know, promoting true information about things like COVID. It seems very quickly from Alex Jones to, you know, Stanford epidemiologists who are critical of lockdowns or people who are 100% in favor of people at risk being vaccinated, but maybe have questions about children and how the risk profile works out there.
Yeah, yeah. That's exactly the problem. In fact, I was looking back today at the initial reactions after Alex Jones was suppressed. And obviously, Alex Jones is a highly controversial figure. He runs the site InfoWars. He's got a very, very bad reputation journalistically among a lot of people, but there were elements to the story about how he was removed that should have raised red flags for media people, which was that this was done behind closed doors, it was done in concert, seemingly along with government officials, although that hasn't been proven, but certainly a very small number of companies got together and they decided in secret that they were going to get rid of this person all at once. And the problem was this created a template where you could replace the traditional litigation-based system for regulating journalists that people like me have had to deal with their whole lives, which is when you screw up, if you get sued, and that's the regulatory mechanism that keeps you honest. Instead of that, we're gonna now have this new system where a handful of sort of oligopolistic tech companies in consultation with the government can simply decide that somebody is unsuitable or a purveyor of misinformation. And it's one thing when it's Alex Jones, but as you point out, in a very short period of time, in less than 3 years, that progressed to people like Jay Bhattacharya from Stanford, Martin Kulldorff, who is a Harvard scientist, Sunetha Gupta, Dr. Aaron Hariati from the University of California system. None of these people are extremists. They're all highly credentialed scientists, and they weren't saying anything that was factually untrue. There was nothing that you could even think about bringing a lawsuit about. They merely had a difference of opinion with official policy. All three of them eventually signed something called the Great Barrington Declaration, which basically said that they thought the government wasn't paying enough attention to age discrepancies in COVID outcomes, that lockdowns were causing mental health outcomes that were outweighing the benefits, and that children, especially, were not at risk. And that's studies in Sweden, where kids were not held out of school, had borne this out, that there hadn't been a single death. And for all that, these scientists became some of the most censored people on Earth. And so that's how quickly this thing devolved from some bad actors or questionable actors to people who are merely disagreeing with the government. And that's what's really dangerous.
On the invite text for this, there's a phrase about a free press is needed to preserve our democracy. But what I thought was remarkable about all this, when it broke, and as we learned more, was that you kept hearing this phrase, it's a nothing burger. Like, not it's not happening, but we all knew it was happening and it's good anyway, from, people in the mainstream media who, the old ethic of journalists used to be, I think, as recently as 10 years ago, a lot of people would have been screaming bloody murder about a government effort to censor people, particularly people who had a different viewpoint that turned out to have a lot of credibility as we learn more. What do you think explains this? And you've said in the past that there is something about how Donald Trump melted everyone's brains and not just the people on his side of the aisle, but some of the people against him.
Yeah, in 2016, in the summer of 2016, there was a very influential New York Times article that was called Donald Trump is Testing the Norms of Objectivity in Journalism. And it was written by a guy named Jim Rutenberg. And the idea of the article was that Donald Trump is so dangerous that we as journalists have to change the way we do business completely. Instead of just worrying about being true, we now have to worry about being true to history's judgment. And so the idea was that journalists had to become more conscious of inspiring the correct political behavior in readers. You know, the old school way, I come from a family of journalists. My father was a reporter here in New York City for ages. I grew up around reporters. The idea we were raised with was that, we get the information right, we put it out there, and it's up to the audience to decide what to do with it, because that's how free societies work. We're not telling you what to do with it. It's you're responsible adults, and we trust you. And that was a relationship, and that's why the media, when it's most effective, is when that relationship is strong. Well, after Trump came along, there was this big change in how people thought about the role of the press. And the new attitude was, we have to do everything possible to make sure that this particular person doesn't get elected. And on top of that, we no longer trust our audiences to make the right decisions. And so we have to keep certain information from them because they might misuse it. So a great example is with the COVID situation. Why was somebody like Martin Kulldorff or Jay Bhattacharya censored? It's not because necessarily they were afraid of the political influence of those people. It's because they believe that if people find out, for instance, that natural immunity actually is effective and that you don't need the vaccine if you've already gotten the disease, that they won't go and get vaccinated. Therefore, that's misinformation. So we can't trust you to know that and go and get vaccinated anyway. We have to keep that information from you. And so, yeah, there was this new ethos about you know, not just telling you what the truth is or giving you information that was important and true, but we also have to make a decision about whether or not this is good for you to know or not. And I think that's what happened with the Twitter files, which was, you know, by any objective standard, any journalist in the world would have loved to do this story, and they all pretended that they were totally uninterested in it. But there was this idea that, you know, they had to tell their audiences that, oh, there's nothing to see here, it's not important that you know that the FBI and the Office of the Director of National Intelligence are regularly talking to 20 of the biggest internet companies in the world. That's a nothing burger. You shouldn't be looking at that. You shouldn't look at these emails. And that's just a new thing for journalists. As you say, 10 years ago when the Snowden thing happened, I think you would have seen a totally different response.
Definitely. Even if it didn't, the response of the establishment press was to downplay it, it did lead to a congressional hearing in March. The Judiciary Committee's Select Subcommittee on the Weaponization of the Federal Government, which is chaired by Jim Jordan, who I imagine you don't ordinarily have a lot in common with politically. This is the part I wanted to ask you about. This sounds like tinfoil hat stuff, but it's true. The same day that you testified before the committee, an IRS agent showed up at your house to leave a note, which, I don't know, is one hell of a coincidence.
Yeah. So that was a very surreal day. I don't know how many people saw that hearing, but it was weird already because Michael Schellenberger and I testified, and we were not asked any questions about the material by any of the members, the Democratic Party members, and they all accused us of all kinds of things. And actually, one of them even said I should take my tinfoil hat off. at one point. But then after we got done with the event, I took a train home to New Jersey, and there had been a note left in my door that the IRS had come at the exact moment I was testifying. And my first thought was, no way, there's no way that this is related. Initially, wasn't going to do anything about it. Then I consulted with some people who I had known who had been elected officials in the past, and they said, no, you better tell the committee about it, because if this is really a thing, then you might be helping somebody do witness tampering, or you're not helping to prevent it. So I told the committee about it, and I didn't say anything about it publicly until we got some information back from the IRS after Jim Jordan sent a query to the IRS, and it came out that they had opened the case on me on Christmas Eve of 2022, which was a Saturday. And it happened to be the day that we released probably the biggest Twitter file story about the relationship between the FBI, Homeland Security, and we even mentioned the CIA in that story. So that's when I think the illusion that it was that it was some kind of coincidence kind of passed away. And I didn't owe any money. In fact, they owed me money. So it was really weird.
Christmas Eve.
Yeah.
Your tax dollars at work. And since then we've had, July 4th decision in a related case, mm-hmm. the Missouri versus Biden case, that sweeps up a lot of this effort to suppress speech online. We've had, first the district court injunction on July 4th. Which everyone just said, this is an outlier, this judge is crazy. He was appointed by Trump, and but then the Fifth Circuit panel in September, I think, has said this is a very real thing. And let me see if I have the quote. The courts have rarely been faced with a coordinated campaign of this magnitude, orchestrated by federal officials, that jeopardize the fundamental aspect of American life. Therefore, the district court was correct in its assessment that unrelenting pressure from certain government officials likely had the intended result of suppressing millions of protected free speech postings by American citizens. Now, my colleagues who work on this issue, we published a paper on, they call this jawboning, mm-hmm. government threats that are sort of like, vaguely Sopranos-y, nice business you've got here. And it's very difficult for courts to police the line between, government speech that's permitted and government speech that has a threat behind it. How do you expect this to play out, and do you think the courts are any kind of long-term solution to this?
I covered the appellate hearing about this issue in Louisiana, and it's funny, two of the three judges in the hearing actually used the exact metaphor you just brought up, invoking the mafia, talking about how when the government says we want you to do this, and it doesn't say what the threat is, it's exactly like a mob organization saying, nice internet company you have there, it sure be a shame if something happened to it. The first time a judge said that, I saw the Biden administration lawyer, a kind of crestfallen look came over his face. The second time it happened with a different judge, he did one of those, because then he knew he could see that the game was up. The ruling that the appellate court eventually handed down was actually, it took quite a big bite out of the injunction, although they just restored a big part of it. They had taken the Department of Homeland Security out of the injunction. Now it's back in. I would say two things. It's very encouraging that the judges who have seen the evidence in this case, which includes, things like Biden administration officials F-bombing Facebook executives and telling them they have to fix something ASAP, or get it down, or inquiring why is something still up, after being told to take something down previously. And this is why the appellate judges decided that it met a very strict test. There's apparently a four-part test that goes into deciding whether or not this is, just protected speech on the part of the government, or whether it's, a violation of the First Amendment. And one of the things is that they were using things that were phrased virtually as orders. That was the language that the courts used. And this is all over the Twitter files. It's all over the evidence in the Missouri v. Biden case, where you see these letters from government officials. They don't tell you what the implied threat is. The implied threat, obviously, is regulatory action or, increased taxation or whatever it is. But they'll say, this has got to go. We want this out right now. Why hasn't this person been acted upon already? No matter whether that's a violation of the First Amendment or not, and they ruled that it was in the case of the White House and the FBI and I believe the Surgeon General's office and one other agency, I think it is a violation of the values of free speech culture, which gets to the other part of your question, which is, no matter how the judges rule, we sort of have a larger problem, which is a decline in respect for free speech culture. It used to be so reflexive in American society, we wouldn't have tolerated this kind of thing, back in the 80s or 90s. You just couldn't have imagined something like this happening. People freaked out at the idea of labels putting on, being put on rock music records. And now people are shrugging their shoulders at whole departments in the government sending out recommendations for content to be taken down. And I think that's reflective of a big cultural change. I don't know about you, but
that was absolutely going to be my next question.
Yeah.
I was reading when I was coming on the down on the train, or up on the train rather, your speech from Freedom Fest in July, where you talk about free speech culture and the idea that, you know, we've got what the courts can do, we've got what the legislatures can do, and you know, we've got actually free speech in terms of Supreme Court doctrine is about as sound as it's ever been in the history of the United States. But, you know, that's pretty fragile when people use the quote in the speech from Judge Learned Hand, liberty lies in the hearts of men and women. When it dies there, no constitution, no law, no court can save it. No, they can't even do much to help it. You also said that, you know, we used to say, none of your damn business when we were asked about politics, defend your right to say what you wanted. And then you said, nobody thinks that way anymore either. Young people especially are worried about, to the point of mental illness, about their likes and ratios. And so I wanted to ask you, you know, we're about the same age, and I frankly thought I'd be a lot older before I got to the stage of full-throated get off my lawn. But how much of this is generational? You know, you alluded to the Tipper Gore and the Parents Music Resource Center. You know, if you're about our age, you remember watching on cable when Frank Zappa and Dee Snider testified before the Senate, and everyone I knew just thought this was, even this little incursion into, you know, just lean on the company a little bit to put a record label on, thought that was horrible. And you sometimes get the idea that Tipper Gore has won her mentality. You know, if you see something that offends you, you know, it should be banned or labeled, has prevailed. So how much of this, in your judgment, is generational, and how much of it, you know, related has to do with the rise of social media itself?
Yeah, that's a good question. Certainly a lot of it, I think, is generational. You know, there was a recent Pew Center survey that showed that majorities of Americans now, a solid majority, I think it was 55 or 56%, now thinks that there should be some restrictions on false information, even if that means you know, less freedom of information. That's kind of a new idea in American society. We've never had you know, somebody outlawing. There's obviously libel, there's slander, there's defamation, but these are, you know, civil litigation categories. There's a new sort of rising movement that believes that free speech and liberal democracy just don't work. I think you'll hear a lot from younger voters, and I heard this, you know, because I cover presidential politics, and I interviewed a lot of younger voters in the last two cycles. There's a lot of pessimism about kind of the American way. There are a lot of younger people who are looking at lives where they don't think they're going to ever own a home, or they're not going to be able to settle down and have families until maybe they're in their late 30s or 40s, and they're angry about that, and they don't value you know, things like free speech. They're not as impressed by the guarantees that are on the Constitution, the things that really, you know, make America different from other places in the world. And they think you know, that maybe they would trade in some of those freedoms for some more economic security. I hear that every now and then. But I also think, you know, this is a process that's been growing for a couple of decades now. I mean, with the war on terror, We started kind of systematically violating civil liberties all over the place. I mean, every one of the Bill of Rights took a hit after 9/11, and we had a state of emergency that was signed by George W. Bush 3 days after 9/11 and was kept being re-signed by every successive president. Joe Biden just did it for the 22nd time, I believe, a month ago. So we've remained in a state of emergency all those years, and secrecy and presidential power have kept expanding, and the implicit argument in all of this is that open society, free society, can't protect itself. It's too strong. It's too weak to survive in a world surrounded by enemies. And that was the ethos under the war on terror. Now in the Trump years, you hear this new argument, which is that democracy can't survive in a world where there's just the forces of reaction and Trumpism. We need something stronger than free speech and, you know, a First Amendment governed democracy to protect ourselves from that. So I think it's this sort of general disdain for civil liberties and freedom as an idea, which is just depressing. I went to school in the former Soviet Union, and I remember just how excited Russians were when they at the end of the Soviet period, and how everyone was just so desperate to meet an American because they just wanted to know what freedom was like and what it was like to be able to do or say whatever you wanted. And I think that there's just a lack of excitement about that, you know, in the United States now. And, you know, we have to do something to bring that back. I'm not sure what that is.
Well, think about it, because we're going to open up for audience questions, but maybe we'll come back around to that at the end and you can bring us up after all the sad stuff we've said today. Who are you guys going to? The microphone is going to come around. And yes, ma'am.
Is it true only on certain geographical sections of the country?
Is what?
The restriction on free speech. That's one question. And the second question is, because you get banned from having certain jobs, if you say something out of line on social media or something about your lifestyle in the past is questionable, in quotes, then you can't get jobs. So there are two questions there.
Well, we definitely saw countless examples of people suffering huge ranges of consequences for saying the wrong thing online. And that could be, you know, we mentioned those scientists. Two of the three of them lost their jobs. We actually saw quite a large number of doctors who lost their jobs just for voicing their medical opinions. But that isn't where it stops. There's a whole range now of kind of coordinated punishments that go along with being judged to be a wrong thinker online. You can be denied banking services. You can be downranked for advertising, which can really hurt your business. You can be obviously taken offline, which is devastating if you're in the media, for instance. There are just a whole range of things that happen to people that are, you know, above and beyond just having your point of view dialed down or de-amplified. We saw there were people who were accused of crimes on January 6th, even of just misdemeanors, who were prevented from using fundraising services to raise money for their own criminal defense. And so, this is before they were convicted. So there are problems here that go beyond speech. There are whole ranges of civil liberties concerns that are built into this because the penalties are expanding in all these different directions. They're trying to coordinate things like your ability to use other kinds of online services, to shop, to advertise, to use payment processing companies like PayPal or credit cards or any of those things. So, and that's not, unfortunately, not limited geographically to anywhere. In fact, it's in countries all over the world as well. So, yeah, it's not good news.
To the point that about employment, I'm gonna plug one of my colleagues' work here, Emily Eakins, who's a director of polling at Cato. She published a poll a couple of years ago that said nearly a third, the results were nearly a third of Americans say they're personally worried about missing out on career opportunities or even losing their job if people knew their actual political opinions, many of which are probably not all that awful. And the same poll said that, 62% of Americans said they had political views they're afraid to share. And the question was, agree or disagree with the political climate these days prevents me from saying things I believe because others might find them offensive. And so that might be part of a direction in culture. I also think there's an element of employment law and the way civil rights law has evolved that also provides an incentive for private employers to tamp down on controversial speech or impolitic speech. And sometimes in these cases, it's hard to, in cases like social media speech suppression and cancel culture in general, it's sometimes hard to tell where state action ends and private action begins. Freda? Sorry, I'm picking on everyone in the front row.
Why isn't there more clamoring to get Facebook and the other social media companies to release their files?
Well, there have been some efforts. The same committee, the Weaponization of Government Committee, did get a lot of files from Facebook, not the amount that we got at Twitter. And they did publish a whole bunch of stuff over the summer. But absent more eccentric billionaires buying these companies, we're just not going to see something like what happened with Twitter probably ever again. That was a very unusual situation. There might be whistleblowers. There are people who come from companies like Google who will tell reporters a few things here and there. But by and large, the mechanisms about how censorship operates, particularly at Google. I think Google is a real black box to reporters. It's just hard to get that information unless somebody wants to give it to us, and that they're not going to do that easily.
I don't know. You dealer's choice.
I want to first thank Cato and Harvard Club for putting this together. It's pretty awesome. Matt, big fan of your Substack.
Oh,
everybody should be. Armchair historian here. If you could put this context of free speech and suppression of it in historical terms, the Sedition Acts of the Wilson era or the McCarthyite era or Nixonian efforts to suppress free speech, where might you put today's climate and efforts?
First of all, thanks for the question. I thought about this exact question on the way here, and I think there's kind of a two-part answer. The first part is that our government now has more capability to get more information about every individual citizen than any government ever has in history, and that includes the Soviet Union, during the KGB years or the NKVD years, or the East Germany under the Stasi. It starts with geolocation. Earlier this year, the director of the FBI, Christopher Wray, admitted that yes, we do purchase geolocation information from third-party vendors. Then we learned that the Department of Defense does it. We also learned that U.S. Customs and Border Protection do it. We're going to learn eventually that they all do it. And here's how that works. How many people have ever downloaded a really silly app on their phone and clicked on it, and it'll say something like, "Hey, do you mind if we use your information for this or that?" And you just want to use the app, so you click yes. Well, it turns out that some of those apps, especially the really silly ones, are selling information about where you are to government vendors. There were extraordinary stories that went under the radar about, for instance, the Department of Defense bought information about 98 million people who had used an app called Muslim Pro, which was designed, it's a little app that helps Muslims orient themselves toward Mecca when they want to pray. And that little app was selling information about where people were. There was another app that was selling, that was designed to help people detect storms in their area. There was another one that was that taught you how to install shelves in your bedroom. The government's buying up all of this information, and that's only part of it. There's this whole galaxy of stuff that they can get. Your entire purchase history, what sites you visit, what social media accounts you've even lurked. Forget about leaving a like or a comment on it. How much time you spend on certain pages. They have details about everybody's individual lives. They can build an extraordinary picture about pretty much everybody without a warrant, even though there are specific Supreme Court cases that say, there's a court case, Carpenter v. United States, that says getting geolocation without a warrant is a violation of the Fourth Amendment, but they do it anyway. So they have the ability to get basically everything about everybody, and they want what they call total visibility into everything, which is why they're constantly campaigning against sites like Signal that encrypt messages, because they don't want people to be able to do encrypted messaging anymore. They think that's a security risk. So that's one thing, is that they can get any information they want about anybody. Are they doing it? We don't know. We do find out, like in cases like with the J6 defendants, that they have, they have enormous amounts of information about people who haven't even committed crimes yet. And this is part of, an evolving situation that began with the war on terror, when they stopped requiring that there be probable cause to start investigating people. And so I think we're in the early stages of kind of this new sort of surveillance state that we don't really know what the end game of it is, but I think it's quite scary. And it's scarier than anything we've dealt with in America before.
I'm going to take a moderator's privilege and ask the last question. You recently wrote that you're researching a book on anti-disinformation, digital surveillance, and other dystopian wonders, which I think your last comments relate to. Tell us just a little bit more about the book, and if possible, a happy story about how we back out of dystopia, how this gets better, or at least what we have to do, or what we should do, as people, as a society, if we want to back out of dystopia and want things to get better.
Yes, I am. So I'm writing a book. This all started, obviously, with the Twitter files, and because of the way that story worked, we weren't able to do a lot of the sort of bigger picture stories that we were seeing. And one of them, probably the biggest story that we couldn't do because it would have taken too much time, was this theme called CT to CP, which is counterterrorism to counterpopulism. A lot of the government agencies that were involved in what they call anti-disinformation work, and these are organizations like the Global Engagement Center at the State Department, or you know, the Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency at the Department of Homeland Security. They were originally designed, these are organizations that grew out of years and years and years of surveilling, conducting surveillance on foreign terrorist organizations and trying to counter recruiting efforts by groups like ISIS and Al-Qaeda. Really, it all started with basically kids in suburban England and in the United States who were responding positively to internet messaging from some of those groups in the Middle East, and people in our government figured, well, what can we do to A, monitor this, and B, counter it? And that, from that little kernel of activity, grew this enormous, you know, $100 million a year industry that's growing bigger and bigger all the time. And when ISIS sort of stopped being as much of a threat, a lot of this capability just got shifted over towards the domestic arena in the United States, in part because of Trump. And now a lot of these same organizations, instead of looking for foreign terrorists, they're looking at what they call DVEs or HVEs, which is domestic violent extremists or human violent extremists. And they're doing basically the same stuff that they were doing with ISIS and Al-Qaeda, but they're doing it here in the United States. And some of this has, you know, some really interesting theoretical roots. You know, I was talking to some folks before the event today, and there's a German philosopher. He was actually a Nazi jurist named Carl Schmitt, and he wrote a book called, I forget, it's actually political theory. I forget exactly what the title was, but the idea of it is that all politics comes down to dividing people into friends and foes. And this is an operating theory that began to be very popular in the military after the war on terror started. And this is absolutely the ethos of what anti-disinformation is all about. The algorithms are entirely designed to figure out who is sort of on the right side and who is, you know, maybe leaning towards, dangerous ideas or ideas in alignment with Russia or anti-vaccine ideas or whatever it is. That's what the algorithms are designed to detect, and they do that constantly. They're searching your behaviors all the time. And this is completely at odds with the ideas that the Cato Institute stands for, the whole idea of individual liberty, rule of law, and pluralism, all those things. Friend and foe is not an American idea, and they're kind of running with it. But I think the good news, to end on a good note, these ideas aren't popular, I don't think. I think they've tried really hard to market it to the population, that we need this, and I don't think most people want it, despite, you know, what some of the polls say. People really don't like to be intruded upon. I don't think they like the idea of being spied on. And there's going to be pushback on this, and it continues to be an issue politically with some of the candidates. So we'll see. We'll see how it goes. But I still have a lot of hope. I have a lot of faith in sort of the American people that they just eventually they're just not going to stand for this much longer. Thank you.